Welcome to SILRAP Podcasts. You are about to listen to a service of the Center for International Law Research and Policy.
Thanks so much, Carsten and Morten. Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here. As Carsten said, my remarks are going to focus on the ICC's two-year preliminary examination in Kenya, which formally ran from December 2007 to November 2009. Give or take. And as the door closes, or perhaps has closed, on this ill-fated intervention, which I would note is only one of two situations thus far have moved from an extended examination phase into an investigation stage, I think the Kenyan experience stands as a cautionary tale for the court. One about the vision, and some might say hubris, with which then prosecutor Moreno Ocampo approached the situation, but also about the methodology and quality of the investigations that were undertaken by the Office of the Prosecutor, about the ability of governments to obstruct and hobble a court that relies on state cooperation to do its work. And more fundamentally, I want to suggest about an overabundance of faith in law and legal institutions to address deep, complex political questions. So before I go further, I want to stress that my comments here do not reflect those of the Open Society Justice Initiative or the foundations. I'm speaking in my personal capacity, and as Carsten already said, much of the research for this paper draws from the dissertation I wrote and was conducted in my former life as a PhD researcher. But just by way of a sort of methodological note, a lot of my insights and some quotes I'll share draw from three separate trips I made to Kenya between June 2011 and late 2012. Where I carried out field-based research on the particular question of whether and how ICC interventions have served as a so-called catalyst for domestic criminal accountability. And in the course of that research, I interviewed a wide array of actors engaged in ICC-related work, I would say. This includes court officials who were working in Nairobi, practitioners in the field of human rights and transitional justice, both INGOs as well as national NGOs, domestic lawyers, judges, and some bar associations, and then also officials from Kenya's Office of the Director of Public Prosecutions, but I should say that was when they were still willing to talk to us. So these interviews have deeply informed my analysis, and I just want to acknowledge the huge debt to my interlocutors, since they're not here to speak for themselves. But the idea of the ICC as a catalyst has obviously dominated much of the literature on complementarity, and in many ways, Kenya was the court's first and best test case for Prosecutor Ocampo to test his now famous quote that the ICC's success should be measured not by how many cases it tries, but how few. I think I'm paraphrasing, but you get the idea. And of course, we know that the cases at the time in the Democratic Republic of Congo, Uganda, and Darfur would go to The Hague. That was sort of the point of the court's intervention, given that they were invited referrals. But success in Kenya was meant to be different. It was meant to show that the ICC was not merely a court, but also that it was, as the prosecutor was so keen to show, a global political player. It had impact. It had a shadow, one that could change the political calculus of regional and national actors. It could bend governments and rebels alike to the rule of law. And a trenchant extended article that ran in the New York Times Magazine last June, which included several interviews with former prosecutor, I would recommend it to those who haven't read it, described Moreno Ocampo thusly, quote, he saw prosecuting Kenyatta as a way to change not just a country, but an entire continent, and in some small measure, the world. So those are not small words, and I quote them here to illustrate the era of what I call magical legalism that informed several key presumptions about the Kenyan examination. And I borrow this term from the sociologist Stanley Cohen, who deployed it in a somewhat different sense. He saw it as a form of interpretive denial that bad acts no longer take place simply because the action itself is illegal. But I think the presumptions that inform the Kenyan experience are similar, and then they too either ignored or failed to adequately appreciate the dynamic political and social conditions that inform the Kenyan situation. Kieran McAvoy notes, for instance, that, quote, a strongly positivistic trend of scholarship and practice persists in the legal understanding of transitional justice. And in his view, legalism is seductive for it, quote, encourages a notion of a rational and ordered place based on universal understandings. And then similarly, Judith Sklar, who was sort of the originator on her famous book on legalism, notes the influence of it as a matter of, quote, rule following, one that seeks to separate legal analysis from politics as well as other disciplines. So I may be oversimplifying slightly here, but I hope I wanted to just lay out that concept sufficiently and then try and identify three ways in which I think magical legalism was at work in the Kenyan situation. And I want to first say I do not limit my critique here to ICC actors alone. I think many of the court's supporters others operated under similar logics. And I'm going to presume that most of us are familiar with the broad contours of the ICC's history in Kenya, but I will do my best to provide a refresher as I go through these 3 points. So first is the presumption that Kenyan politicians, specifically parliamentarians whose task it was to pass necessary legislation, would prefer the prospect of a domestic accountability mechanism to the ICC. This seemed to be the premise upon which both the Waki Commission and Prosecutor Moreno Ocampo's threat of the Hague was premised. However, the defeat of the Special Tribunal Bill in Kenya in early February 2009 owed to a critical minority of parliamentarians who actually saw the prospect of a domestic tribunal as the greater threat. Led by former MP, now Deputy President William Ruto, the latter formed a bloc of MPs who favored the ICC in part because it was seen to be the safer bet. It would prosecute fewer suspects, and the proceedings, it was believed, would undoubtedly last longer than the next Kenyan election cycle. In short, although key factions of the Kenyan political elite feared the ICC, it was not feared enough. So I think the failure of the first SDK bill, shorthanding it, which had been shepherded by then Minister Martha Karua and was really the only piece of legislation to meaningfully advance, was largely the product of an unholy alliance between those MPs, unholy alliance is a quote from an interlocutor, between those MPs who opposed it because they feared being implicated in the post-election violence and those who favored accountability in principle but lacked faith in the idea of a domestic process that would displace the ICC. So while the phrase "don't be vague, go to the Hague" emerged as part of Kenya's political lexicon to ostensibly indicate a preference for the ICC's involvement, it also signaled that many saw the court as a more limited threat. And as several interlocutors noted, several MPs may well have had much to gain from any potential ICC arrest warrants, which could have the effect of removing rivals from the domestic political arena. Second, while complementarity's coercive dimension was clearly the dominant logic behind the Commission of Inquiry's invitation that the ICC become involved in Kenya, and that's a role that, again, I think the prosecutor appeared welcomed and if not relished, hindsight begs one to consider how much coercive power the ICC actually held. And I think crucial to this question is the timing, duration, and modality of the ICC's examination. The Waki Commission's report was released in October 2008, so that was nearly 1 year into the formal examination. Yet during this time, there is little evidence that I found that the OTP undertook significant field missions to Kenya or that there was any serious attempt to meaningfully engage with victims and affected communities. Of course, communication channels existed between state-level actors in Kenya and the office from at least February of that year, but as Lionel Nichols has noted in his study of the Kenyan interventions, and this accords with my own assessment, the office's public engagement was largely conducted, quote, through press statements and media interviews rather than through face-to-face meetings. Similarly, a filing from the victims' representatives in the case against Ruto and Tsang stated that the OTP had not conducted, quote, a meaningful investigation into eyewitness experiences and that the victims, who numbered nearly 300 at the time, had reportedly not been interviewed by the OTP, were not anywhere aware of anyone in their locality having been interviewed, nor were they aware of the prosecutor ever having come to their localities to conduct on-site investigations. So following the government's failure to establish the domestic tribunal, more direct and frequent contact between the OTP and national level actors did take shape, and I sort of traced this through the public record. However, the power of the examination period was arguably at its peak prior to that time, during the January 2008 to February 2009 period, buttressed as it was by the commission's ongoing investigation and the active role of Kofi Annan, who had yet to hand the commission's envelope over to The Hague. But this appears to be when the OTP's presence was the most remote. And this dynamic continued and deepened over the course of 2009, after the failure of the bill. But I think retrospectively, the wisdom of continuing to engage with the government, whose proposals became increasingly incoherent after the failure of Karua's bill, should be questioned. As Mutoni Wanyeki, a Kenyan activist, wrote in late 2009, quote, the state has done just enough, the bare minimum, to maintain the masquerade that it intends to pursue criminal justice for the organized violence on both sides of the political divide, end quote. And so I would suggest that perhaps the length of the ICC's preliminary examination here may well have prolonged that masquerade. I think a paradox lay at the heart of the Kenyan experiment insofar as the ICC's greatest supporters, victims and affected communities, their advocates, and the NGO community in Kenya, as well as a large INGO community, fundamentally saw the ICC's involvement as a necessary condition for any national accountability process. Kenyan civil society in particular, while not a monolith, took an exceedingly dim view of the government's willingness to pursue accountability in the absence of external proceedings. It was precisely because of their distrust in what they considered a compromised judicial system that was beholden to the executive that the core features of the proposed special tribunal, that it would be located outside of the domestic justice system with international judicial participation, were seen as non-negotiable, and why the perceived compromises in Karua's legislation, notably with respect to presidential immunities, was viewed with such suspicion. Put differently, the civil society sector's trust in the Kenyan government and faith in its institutions was so low that most were reluctant to support any domestic legal reform efforts until after the ICC intervened. As prominent Kenyan advocates have argued, any advocacy for creating a judicial mechanism, quote, had to take place after the commencement of the Kenyan cases. In their words, quote, given the pervasive climate of impunity, many organizations feared that any domestic accountability processes might be hijacked to justify an admissibility challenge before the ICC. Similarly, in another study of the advocacy strategies of Kenyan NGOs during the ICC preliminary examination, two commentators have noted that, quote, in most cases, even the NGOs that actually had the power to impact national criminal justice system reform were inclined instead to encourage ICC intervention at the time that the preliminary examination was being conducted. So three presumptions to restate that I think drove Kenya's preliminary examination. One, that Kenyan politicians would necessarily prefer a domestic mechanism to international judicial intervention. Two, that the latter would be a sufficient threat to create such a mechanism, and that deeper field-based engagement and independent evidence gathering by the OTP was not necessary. And this might link back to the point of outcome versus process. I think it was more outcome-driven than process-driven. And finally, that accountability advocates would support a domestic process in lieu of the ICC. So I think these three together demonstrate the allure of legalism and how it reflects, again in McAvoy's words, a capacity to disconnect from the real political and social world of transition. In actuality, legal formations in Kenya were subordinated to a dynamic politics of transition, one that, as I have mentioned, saw politicians on both sides of the accountability divide unite to defeat the prospect of a domestic tribunal, to abandon it almost entirely, and indeed for some amongst them to then construct a powerful and compelling narrative or counter-narrative of victimhood at the hands of a neocolonial project. Few foresaw that one perverse outcome of the ICC's intervention would be to bring Kenyatta and Ruto, former political enemies, together in victory, at which point any hope of meaningful cooperation with the court, it's safe to say, was clearly lost. And in Moreno Ocampo's words, which is in this New York Times Magazine article, which stood out to me, quote, I never suspected they, Kenyatta and Ruto, were so smart to create the ticket. End quote. To that end, and in closing, I suggest that while the current historical narrative tends to overlook how close Kenya came to establishing a special tribunal, and with it a potentially larger process of accountability, a series of presumptions drove the design and duration of the OTP's examination. These presumptions offer a number of instructive lessons for improving the quality control of examinations going forward, and they include, as I have elsewhere argued, a more cooperative, place-based approach to examinations. Now, I caveat this with not all circumstances might permit this, although I think in Kenya for a period of time it was possible. Also, a more calculated and rigorous effort to gather evidence rather than waiting for the investigation stage to formally begin. And third, greater attunement to the sui generis context of ICC interventions and to the shifting political dynamics in which they unfold. This likely requires having greater, savvier national political acumen at the OTP's constant disposal. More fundamentally, however, I think it also entails a, quote, letting go, and again, in McAvoy's words, of the seductions of legalism, or at least a more honest reckoning with its limitations. Sarah Kendall and Sarah Nowen, speaking of the legacy of the Rwandan tribunal, have similarly called for a, quote, ethos of institutional modesty, which may prove instructive for the ICC and its supporters as well. Fortunately, it appears the OTP has already learned at least some of these lessons, judging by important policy changes to its investigative strategies and methodologies, and the early practice of other more recent preliminary examinations. But I think we must acknowledge that the Kenyan cases were a painful lesson for victims and the court to bear, and one hopes that they need not be learned again. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For more open access audio recordings, films, and publications, go to silrap.org.